argument today, August 2nd, 2018, is case number 17-6032, N. Ray Aaron R. Kemp, etc., Aaron R. Kemp versus the United States Department of Education.
Good morning, folks. We have the Kemp versus Department of Education case. We have Mr. Forrest Holzer for the appellant.
Yes, Your Honor.
Come forward.
Forrest Holzer for the appellant, Aaron Kemp. We're here today on this case to determine whether the bankruptcy court's failure to discharge Ms. Kemp, the appellant's student loans, is contrary to the 523A of the bankruptcy code, the under partial provision. The standards of review are de novo of the law and clear error for the facts. In this case, the debtor testified, which would be on page 5162 of the transcript, that she has expenses for cell phone, cable, and internet. The cell phone bill is paid to Verizon, the cable internet is paid to Cox. That's also reflected on her 2016 tax return, which was entered into evidence. It is also reflected on her bank statements, which were entered into evidence. There's no dispute that she has these expenses, or there can be no dispute, but the court failed to consider those expenses. The court did not disallow the expenses, it simply failed to account for or consider three relevant expenses: cable, internet, and cell phones. The appellant listed those expenses. They're not on the budget, but she listed a net business expense. The bankruptcy court concluded that her budgetary surplus was $105, meaning she had the ability to pay $105 for her debt. So the failure to account for $300 is a very significant error. This court should be come away with a firm conviction that an error was made, and just because of that error, because under the court's own calculation, once you add those expenses, she's in the negative, has no ability to pay.
Which is relevant only to the present circumstances, right?
Yes, Your Honor, currently,
best involves past, present, and future financial resources, right?
Yes, Your Honor, and the future, the best way to predict the future, the starting point is the current situation. So under the court's own calculation, currently, once you add those $300 in, she has no ability to pay. And in fact, she's on zero payment. The appellant has a child care business. The court concluded on page 5 of the opinion that the total expenses, it didn't consider cable, internet, and cell phone, but the expenses for food and gas total $230 a month. They said there was a gross income of $900, and that the net from the business was $670, so $230 a month of expenses. 230 times 12 is 2,760. In that same paragraph, the court says that the debtor spends $25 a day in the summer for the two kids she has in the summer.
Counsel, were all of these numbers included on the amended budget that was submitted to the court just prior to trial?
No, ma'am, they were not, because the net is...
So let me ask you this then. On the tax returns, it seems that there's an argument that because there are deductions on the tax return that reduce the overall taxable net income to the business,
yes, ma'am,
that's what should be utilized in this test, which is really more a cash basis. So I'm trying to understand what failure or what error the bankruptcy court engaged in when they did not use the deduction model formula, but rather just use cash in and cash out.
They didn't consider the cell phone, internet, cable at all. Under the court's analysis.
If they didn't include it in the budget, why would the court consider it?
Because what happened is that the debtor listed net income of $100. The court's calculation then was $670, six times what's on the budget. And the debtor testified that what's on the budget is net income, meaning gross income minus expenses. That is what is on the budget.
But was she using it off the tax return? Was that where she got the net income figure?
The net income on the 2016 taxes is $564 in the business, I believe, for the year. So cell phone, internet, and cable, and deduct those. It looks to me like going forward, you know, the reason less than might be $200 a month. The $100 a month was based on the 2016 tax return. But the under the court's analysis, $1,050 is spent just on food in the summer, meaning 38% of the total expenditures are just for food in the summer. And what that leaves you with is, under the court's analysis, she's spending $190 a month for the other 9 months for food and gas, which seems there's no basis for that differential. Judge Chauvin, in her dissent in the Hearst case, 2015, noted that a court is not allowed to make unsupported adjustments to the budget. And just looking at the figures for the business expenses for food and gas, I don't think it's unsupported. That seems to be a clear error. I think it's important when we're talking about the probabilities here to keep in mind the evidentiary standard, which is preponderance of the evidence, the typical standard of civil cases, which means essentially more likely than not. So we're not talking about possibilities, we're talking about probabilities. You know, it's possible that Deborah win the lottery or marry a billionaire. It's also possible she'll be out on the street, but those aren't probabilities. And so the debtor testified that she's in the process of buying a house. That's on 9393 of the transcript. That will result in an increased maintenance expense and utility expense.
How is she going to do that if her budget's negative?
Your Honor, she testified that she would have to borrow the down payment from her mother, and she also testified that the mortgage payment would be essentially the same as her rental payment. The most she could afford is a $90,000 house with a government subsidy. It'd be an HUD loan. Although it doesn't appear that she can pay for a car or house based on her current budget, but she is in the process of trying to buy a house. The court allowed an expense for anticipated car payment, but it didn't factor in, which the debtor testified to, and which is common knowledge, that when you're financing a car, you have to have full coverage. That testimony is on page 167 of the transcript. Her auto insurance expense will go up. She also testified that she'd like to take a vacation, and possibly this is my fault for calling a vacation, but she allotted $50 to go on a weekend trip to a nearby location, which, you know, that comes to $600 in a year, and the court disallowed that expense. That may have been just a semantic objection. The debtor spends $150 for transportation, so if that had been lodged for transportation, definitely it would have been okay. The debtor spends $50 in her payment, but the court would not allow her to take, she has a 13-year-old daughter, to take a weekend trip to Tulsa or Branson or somewhere close to Solomon Springs. I would also like to say,
so again, you're still talking solely about the present financial circumstances?
Yes, Your Honor, but also she's testifying that she doesn't have the money to take a vacation, which is apparent from the budget. She's in the negative.
But it's under the present financial circumstances.
Yeah, the present financial circumstances. If it became available, she would like to take her daughter somewhere besides Solomon Springs every once in a month, or once a year.
But does that desire override the requirement that she may even understand the lines? I mean, I understand that vacations and family time is important, and I'm not suggesting that they're not. But I think that the court's in a position where they have to make decisions based on, you know, what may happen in the future and what's, you know, necessary for a minimal standard of living. And if her daughter, you know, goes to college in 4 years and she's going to get a full scholarship, maybe she'll work full time at Lowe's. Why should that not be taken into consideration as well as her current income? That's what the test requires.
It should be, Your Honor. The fact that her daughter will go to college, probably, and that she will return to work full-time at Lowe's should absolutely be taken into consideration. The point on the vacation is she spends $150 on transportation, $50 on their payment. If she had $100 on their payment or $200 on transportation, presumably that would have been okay, because those are very low expenditures. I would also like to point out that the standards of the totality of the circumstances, and what this court does is, when they consider an expense, if they adjust an expense or disallow an expense, according to the court, if so facto, that results in an ability to pay in the amount of that expense. And that is not a totality. That's what I would call a cherry picking method. This court considered a case in 2010, the Walker case. The debtor in that case had an $850 car payment and also had a $300 some odd payment for a second mortgage. If you don't consider the totality, what this court said is, yes, we don't like those expenses, but considering the total situation, they're going to stand. If you don't consider the totality, you end up with a wide, arbitrary range of results. You'll have a situation where one debtor can't spend $200 on transportation, but another debtor could have a $700 car payment.
Aren't the facts in the Walker case pretty distinguishable from the facts in this case?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe the facts in almost every single case are distinguishable. Like this case, it's very distinguishable from Jefferson. But my point is, if you don't look at the total expenses, you'll end up with a very wide range arbitrary results. The courts look at the total amount of expenses, which in this case are very low. And if you don't, it's not a totality. The court would definitely, if the debtor had two jobs, they wouldn't just consider one. That's not a totality. So the same rules should apply to expenses.
Well, see, this is, I think your argument goes kind of both ways. I think what the bankruptcy judge did was look at the totality because he looked at the past financial circumstances and her future potential financial circumstances, not just her cable bill, but her cell phone bill. Right? So it sounds like what you're arguing is exactly what the bankruptcy judge did. Look at the totality of the financial circumstances, past, present, and future.
Judge Saldino, my point is that for expenses, if a court disallows a transportation expense, that is a factor that should result in pay without considering the totality of the expenses. Otherwise, more frugal debtors are penalized. And then
if I'm understanding correctly, what you're arguing is essentially a subset of the totality of the circumstances case. This would apply, you're talking about applying only to the income and expense analysis. So that when we look at the totality, it would almost be like the totality of the expenses test within the totality of the circumstances test, which looks at things other than the income.
Yes, Your Honor, it should apply to both income and expenses in totality. Your Honor, I'm at my yellow light. I'm going to reserve the rest of the time for rebuttal. Thank you.
So, there, Mr. Green.
May it please the Court. Morning. Your Honor, the debtor brings, in my opinion, three main issues on appeal. And those three main issues revolve around the miscalculation. The debtor did talk about the miscalculation of the potential premier made, but I believe that this court is satisfied with the premier has made, and I will be prepared to go to the argument as to that. As to the debtor's three main issues that he brings on appeal, first is whether or not there's an open question in this circuit as to the standard that should be applied, whether or not the debtor on the day of trial can make payments on the student loan or can pay off the entire student loan debt. Second, that there's an open question as to whether or not there should be given dispositive effect as to the eligibility and enrollment in an IPR. Third, that this court should hold that $0 IPR payment is not a payment. I will briefly summarize the United States response to each one of those points and go into detail as to each one of those factors and why they are unfounded, why there is no open question in the circuit, or why the trial court decision should be affirmed. Now, first, there is no open question in this circuit that there is not dispositive effect given to the factor of being enrolled in an income-based repayment plan by the IPR. As you stated, Judge Shogin affirmed. Stated that in this circuit, IBR is a relevant factor, but it cannot be considered the only factor.
Let's think about that for just a minute, because you know if the IBR is not the dispositive factor, what about the cases that have discussed in this circuit the debtor's voluntary decisions or decisions that the debtor makes that reduce their income?
Debtor's voluntary decision to
reduce their income.
Yes, Your Honor, it should be a factor.
And isn't that what happened here?
Yes, Your Honor. It's a self Commissioner Schoening confirmed and stated that this court does not interpret Jefferson to stand in the proposition that $0 payment constitutes an ability to pay. And again, nor did the bankruptcy court make its decision that Ms. Kim, in this case, can make a $0 payment in the future, and therefore, she should not be able to discharge her student loan. Lastly, even if there was a valid argument that these questions were open, and this court determines that there is an open question as to one of any of those three issues, in this case, it is clear that under the totality of circumstances test, Ms. Kim should not have her student loan discharged.
In your mind, did the bankruptcy court prepare the calculation of the present expense? Well, present financial circumstances is common sense.
No, Your Honor, I do not. I like language that was stated in the P.O. Kim Club. It's 262F3D75, the west side of the Jefferson Assembly. It says, for a finding to be clearly erroneous, it must strike the court as more than just maybe or probably wrong. It must strike the court as wrong in the force of a 5-week-old unrefrigerated fish. In this case, there is no fish in the refrigerator.
That is a fairly good question. My question is, the counsel pointed out specific expenses that the bankruptcy judge should account for. But is that a correct statement or incorrect?
Your Honor, I do not believe that. It is an incorrect statement. I do not believe, when you go through the standard overview, which is, again, the how rigorous the standard is for clearly erroneous. There's also standards in the case law of the state. There's different interpretations. The court must be given deference. In this case, there are multiple interpretations as to the debtor's expenses. For example, the debtor testified on cross-examination that the monthly food expenses for daycare were $200. On redirect, she testified that it's between $300 and $400. On the debtor's tax returns, it equals a monthly expense of $250. So you have four different numbers, four different interpretations. The judge took the totality of the circumstances, all the evidence that was in court, and made a determination as to the expenses for food. As to the expenses for transportation, in the debtor's budget, the debtor was $150 for transportation costs. And then the debtor's tax return, the debtor was an amount of $2,948 or $240. There's all these different interpretations that can be made from these expenses. And again, there are multiple interpretations before it must be given deference. And Judge Schoening, as you stated earlier, I do believe there's double dipping in this case. At trial, Ms. Kim admitted that her and her daughter eat some of the food that they buy for the daycare. So she has food expenses in her budget of $450 per month, and then she has the food expenses for her daycare as somewhere around $3,000.
Would that same analysis apply to the cable, Wi-Fi, and the cell phone?
Your Honor, I think you stated it perfectly in your questions with Mr. Forrester. There is multiple interpretations because, yes, she did testify during trial that she has a $150 cell phone, $150 cable internet bill,
does it self-funded.
That's correct.
She has the ability to pay without any departure.
That's correct. And again, in Fern, I believe Judge Shokin stated that this court can affirm on any valid basis on the record below. Your Honor, as to whether the standard is the debtor's ability to make the payments and not the entire student loan debt, again, if the question is for, as Jefferson has said, if he has sufficient income to make payments, then that is the standard.
Are you aware of any cases that support the proposition, even the totality of circumstances or some of the tests that says that the loan must look to as though the entire loan can be repaid?
Your Honor, I do believe the debtor has cited two cases to lower courts that talk about that. But again, the Eighth Circuit judges clearly states is sufficient income to make payments on the student loan debt.
But that's when the student loan debt is quite large compared to, you know, what needs to be repaid. You know, I'm trying to recall the cases that were cited. I think one may have been out of Minnesota when they talk about, you know, the debts like $200,000 or $300,000, and I may be misstating the exact amount. But that's not the case we have here. So can we take that into account with the debt slips?
Your Honor, I think that rules in favor of the bankruptcy court. She has a higher likely chance of not only just making payments, but paying off the entire debt for her life. If she's on an IDR, if she has a 25-year IDR, she should be able to pay this off. If she makes the decision to work for full-time and maximize her income, even if she's not an IDR, she has a good chance to pay this off.
Does the record reflect what the amount of the IDR payment would need to be for her to pay off within the 25 years?
Your Honor, there was evidence at trial that the debtor was aware that the Department of Education had offered her to make a $30 a month payment. While in our position is that the debtor indicated that she could make that payment.
Here, that was my exact question. If debtor had unlimited resources, which I guess would disqualify her for an IDR, but what's the amount that would be required to pay off loan over a 25-year period?
I'm sorry, under an IDR or just in general?
Just in general. Is there anything correct that would let us do that?
Your Honor, not that I'm aware of, other than the fact she was making a $350 payment while she was working with Arbus, leaving to believe that that's the payment that the note said that's what she was making, to make a $350 payment for the life of the loan, and the loan would be
okay,
as to the third potential issue on appeal, whether or not $0 IDR payment constitutes the ability to pay. Again, to confirm Judge Shokin stated, we do not interpret, this panel does not interpret Jefferson's stand for the proposition that $0 payment equals the ability to pay. And again, the bankruptcy court did not give any conclusive effect to the fact that she's currently on $0. If you have any other questions.
Future financial resources will cover payment of the student loan debt and allow a minimum standard of living, then the debt should not be discharged. So that references payment of the student loan debt. There's also...
So you interpret that to mean the total balance of the debt, not the loan?
Yes, ma'am, I would. I would also point out the purpose of 523AA, which is to prevent presumed abuses, which that purpose has been accomplished. You know, 1 out of 1,000 debtors tries to discharge for student loans. The other purpose is the financial integrity of the student loan system. If the standard is not tied to the reduction of the debt, what purpose does it serve? If the debt is going to continue to grow, that does not further the financial integrity of the system. And what the appellant is asking here is for this court to clarify the standard, because the bankruptcy court quoted Jefferson for the proposition that if you can make payments under an IVR, then the debt should not be discharged. There's conflicting law in the Eighth Circuit, and as the situation stands now, the trial judge is unfettered. They can pick out a statement saying, well, if you make an IVR payment, it should be discharged. They could also say IVR is simply a factor, or under law,